Jane Balagay in New York. So good to have you with us. Award-winning analyst, journalist, author, CBS family as well, family of all of us. Family for me, even longer, because we were at Sky together back. We were talking about this in the car on the way over here, I think 10 years ago, maybe, something like that, right?
Even more, yeah, around that, yeah.
Where we did Sky together, we did Spanish football together. That was my first gig hosting live football. I'd never hosted live football. I'd always done sports news, anything like that, but that was my first gig doing sports, live sports, and you made it very easy for me. I'm grateful to you. Made it fun.
Because we got that friendship going on, can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Can I sit there or there?
What? What? Why? You don't like the middle seat?
It's like, not just a middle seat, just a... I prefer to ask the questions, but do you remember what you told me the first day they came to the show?
No.
Because, of course, I have been doing it. I started in the Sky in 97, so...
You were the king of that show. You were the Don.
We've done it for a long time, yeah, and shaped it to be a little bit different and already wearing different clothes. And I remember wearing leather jackets and the producers going like, no leather jackets, man. I mean, we got this other blue jacket that you can wear. So it was a constant battle, as it's been since, in terms of wearing clothes. But you came over, you said, before they put you the microphone and everything, I said, would you help me? Would you help me? Just, it's my first gig presenting. And I'm thinking, don't say that. I was going to say exactly the same to you, because you were so smooth. You were really top in the way you were doing things. And I'm thinking, don't give me weakness. I want strength here. But I think I hide that and just became the strong one for the first couple of shows. And after that, it was dead easy. To do it with you, that easy.
Guillaume makes it easy to do any show with him because you function in every role. That's the great thing about you. You can be the interviewer, you can sit where we are, but you can also be the host, you can also be the analyst. So I just got to sit back. I enjoyed myself.
Now, do you have a preference in those different roles?
I'm not the story, so I'd rather tell the story. If I'm something, is a storyteller.
More than an interviewer, you would consider yourself, or a newsbreaker, you would consider yourself a storyteller.
I love chatting, so I love interviewing people and discovering people and creating magic. You know that moment that you do so often of where you forget that you've been filmed and things come up that you don't expect, and that has happened sometimes where you hear something that makes you feel emotional or it's completely off course. When you do that, that is great. But first and foremost, I'm a storyteller in whatever format, in books, podcast, television, whatever. And this may shock you a bit, but I don't love football. Sorry, I'm not passionate about the game. It's something I'm thankful to the game for what's allowed me to do. And I'm a chairman of a football club, and I've got my coaching badges, and all I've been doing since 95, 96, it's football. But it's been an excuse to actually get to know people, elite people, how you think, how you got to where you got to, the people that help you, the stories of games, that has been my real passion.
It's a shock. It's a complete shock to me that you don't love football, considering that you're everywhere. You know, you watch the David Beckham documentary series. You're there asking questions.
Right, yeah.
Whenever there's a Lionel Messi topic, debate, you're at the center of it. So when was that breakthrough for you in this space of football that this is what I'm going to do? I'm going to be storytelling within football.
That is interesting because I get a lot of young journalists saying, you know, I want to do what you do. My first answer is, well, I do what I do, so you're going to have to wait. but then it's like, why do you want to become a football journalist that talks about big stars and does it in a television show or whatever? Why don't you become a journalist first? Somebody that prepares himself for whatever may come, because eventually it has happened to me, you don't choose your career, you don't choose where you go, you just go along with it and be prepared for it. And that happened, Sky was the big breakthrough. So I was living in England with my brother was there as well, heard that a Spanish radio show, we're massive on radio, and football radio shows are the biggest shows that are even ahead of television. And one radio show that gets broadcasted at midnight was done from London that particular day, and my brother said, come over, let's go. We went, and there was some guy there that actually studied with me, said, I'm the editor of this magazine, football magazine called Un Balón. I'll talk about football, English football, great. And then a year later, Sky started doing Spanish football. So I rang them and I said, right, I'm the correspondent of Un Balón, and I want to write about what you do in Sky about Spanish football. Dave Lawrence, can't remember if he was producing when you were there, no. Dave Lawrence was the producer. Now, this is how I remember it. And I spoke to Dave about this. This is not how it happened, but I don't care. This is how I'm going to always tell the story, which is that he said, OK, yeah, come over on a Saturday and we'll show you what we do. So I went in and I didn't have big, good clothes or, you know, so I asked a friend of mine to give me some, like, you know, the presence is always important. But he was 20 stone, and I was thinner, so the back was like this. It was a big jacket. I had longer hair, big glasses. Went in. And Dave says, right, well, this is the gallery. This is where the producers are, the directors, da da da. This is the presenter, David Bobbin. And this is where you sit next to him. The show is starting in half an hour.
Oh, what?
And I'm going, you've done this before? Hundreds of times. I said, that was my debut on television.
Oh, wow.
And at halftime of that game, I cannot remember what the game was. He said, well, we're thinking of doing a show on Spanish football, highlights and whatever, you want to do it? I was like, yeah. He'd asked about three other people and they all said no. If one of them had said yes,
you wouldn't be there.
The story would have been completely different. But what happens when you're on television, you enter different era and a different world, really, because you start knocking doors, and just because you're in television, you can go to a training session, you can go to the sporting city of a big club, you can, as it has happened, I've never met
the
you before.
The access that it gives you.
Yeah.
Right.
And we're talking to each other as best mates, because we see each other on television. So the first time I was in Liverpool at the time, I went to Melwood, and Stevie G and Jamie Carragher were like, oh, hello, Guillem. And it's like, I've never ever met you, but of course, through television.
Jamie was very friendly
that time.
Wow.
That time. One of the hardest moments in my career was because of Jamie, but that's a different story. So I was very close to Rafa Benitez when Jamie was obviously playing
former
for
Liverpool
Rafa.
Manager.
Former Liverpool
right.
manager. And Rafa and I were very, very close. And he would talk to me all the time about things that were going on. And I had this column in the Daily Mirror, which is a tabloid magazine in the UK, where I told a story that happened in the changing room at Liverpool. Now, the Daily Mirror just edited completely different, added new words, made it even more spectacular than it was. But the essence of the story was there. And Jamie went into the changing room when everybody was there and went to Rafa and says, Rafa, knowing that we had a relationship, you should stop talking to this. And he used some words that we cannot use here.
Oh, we can.
I've seen that you use those words.
So go ahead. Let's hear them.
We need color to this story, so give it all. Go ahead.
They don't come natural. But it was like, stop talking to him. And Rafa hadn't told me that story. But he looked around in the changing room, and he knew who had. And looked at him. And the player went like this. And Rafa said, yeah, it was me. Apologies to everyone. It was me. I will not talk to him ever again. Sorry, Jamie. And he said, it was Riera, the player. Says, Rafa said to Riera, Riera, can you stay behind? Let's have a word. And then Rafa went to me like, I'm never ever going to speak to you. I cannot believe you put this in the paper. Jamie thinks that you're at trouble. They don't want you near Melwood ever again. And I said, but Rafa, we speak every day. Yeah, but that's different. That's different. But you know, that's an interesting part of talking to you. I'm not sure how you deal with a journalist that is so much in, especially if it doesn't tell you a story or exposes you. I imagine that you found yourselves in this situation. Do you blame the journalist or do you blame yourself for having got into trouble? What'd you do?
No, they blame the journalist.
100%. It's never our fault.
We're the messenger.
How could it be our fault? That's crazy.
But you did do whatever thing you did.
Yeah, do you ever feel uncomfortable, though, publishing stories and feeling like, man, I'm compromising this player?
We publish, I publish 10% of what I know. And I think, I guess, that's what develops relationships. You don't tell everything. You just tell things that serve a purpose for the story or for the moment or the place you are or what you're talking about, so.
You ever got that judgment wrong?
Yeah, once that it came to my head, I completely forgot about it. Thank you very much, Kate. with David Beckham and Fabio Capello. David and I had a really good relationship. I saw him recently in Milan, and he was, he's lovely. He really is lovely. And he straight away, because we were doing Revista La Liga, we were the only place in the UK where you could tell what was going on in Spain. So he knew that through me, his story will come out into the UK, whatever he's doing with Real Madrid when he went there. And then, of course, when he signs for the LA Galaxy, Fabio Capello, thinking that he was going to be stop being the professional that he is, pushes him aside and starts training on his own. And some of the conversations that happened there with Fabio and him were, he just could not understand it. It just drove him mad. It was so unfair. It's like, you know, yeah, okay, I am actually going because I feel it's the right time, and there was a lot of reasons for it, and he explains it in the documentary. But I use some of that stuff to tell how unfair it was, because obviously everybody bought the Fabio Capello stroke club version,
right,
that David wasn't going to be having the head on it. And I was trying to say no. And David told this to Fabio, and Fabio still... Blah, blah, blah. And Fabio went to him the next day and says, David, in that meeting in which I told you this, there was only you and me. And I did not tell that story. So it was you. You do it again, and you're out. And he was already out. So out of where he was like out of the training ground.
Right.
So David, you know, told me off and said, no, this is not it. And you know how it goes with you. It's black and white. You get it wrong once.
Then you're
you lose trust.
Yeah. You're gone, Andrew. You're gone.
The trust is out. I mean, how can you trust someone if you feel that you can tell them some of these things in confidence, knowing what they do, and then all of a sudden, when the moment asks for it, at least from the public's point of view, and that writer or journalist puts it out there, and you're like, whoa.
Don't you as the player then have the responsibility to be very specific about, hey, this part isn't for public consumption?
Well, I think in a lot of cases, you assume that they wouldn't cross the line.
Do all players have this? Does every player, do a lot of players have this? A journalist that they consider their go-to person? I know you're like, hell no,
because
you had no trust in media.
I wouldn't say that, but I just kind of stuck to myself. I didn't play the game. I was just kind of like, well, you know, hopefully I'm good enough that I play well enough that I continue playing.
You know, yeah, what I
mean? Did you speak to somebody?
No, I didn't have a journalist that I would call just through playing, you see familiar faces, the journalists that are trying to create that relationship. And you're like, all right, this person's cool, or they wrote something nice about you that your parents feel proud about. And you're like, all right, I respect this journalist. You know, they're always trying to shape it in a positive way, even if you don't have a good game, versus the journalist that's like, horrible, change them, take them out. You know, so I understand the connection, but at the same time, you're like, you keep a little bit of a distance.
I think I've seen all of that, right? Like there's some players who are very clever, and as much as you're saying you're giving them information with the trust that they're not going to put everything out there, there's also players who are using them
to shape the narrative.
Yeah, they're right. Feeding them information that they know they want to get out there, or
whether it's to get more playing time, whether it's to get moves away from the club, or whether it's to get a new deal.
So it's like it's a relationship that. It's a tricky one because, to Guillaume's point, it is, as soon as that trust is betrayed, it's a wrap.
But it's not easy because it's very tricky because I've got lots of friends in the game, loads, and they tell me lots of stories. They never tell me, this is what you can say,
this is on the record, this is off the record.
You develop relationships based on that trust. But there are times, I wouldn't say, oh, but don't forget that I'm a journalist when I'm talking to you. Do forget it, please, because I'm not a journalist first. I'm a person who, I know you're going through your own thing, so I'd rather help if I can with that than publish a story. But sometimes the stories get published, and I haven't got it wrong many times, but it's a tricky line that you sometimes cross, and yeah, it will affect you. Or it will affect you and you only realize that I was doing it for you good, 10 years down the line, which has happened as well. I've had many nights not sleeping because I got the text that destroyed me or said, you know, I got it wrong or whatever it was. Just kills you. I cannot deal with that. So even now I wouldn't use some of the stuff that I know because that may just upset somebody that may haven't met for 20 years, may not meet again. But if I feel that somebody will just have something against me, I'll hate it. I cannot deal with it. So imagine being a journalist that you have to put stories out there and you cannot deal with it.
That's such a tough balance to try to figure out.
Not easy.
So in the Jamie story that you tell, he obviously pinpointed Rafa Benitez in his mind as the guy that was talking to the journalist. I'm interested, like from the locker room perspective, do you guys always feel like you have a sense of, this story's come out this morning. We all know. We know who it was.
There's always people that you know are a little bit more friendly. Some people keep it under wraps, but you always have a sense of like guys who are a little bit more friendly with the media or after training or in the mix zone after a game. It's like, he's still talking to him a little
bit.
You
judging that?
I'm not judging, to each their own. But when a story comes out now.
Well, it sounds like you're judging.
You can read it. You can see the mannerisms, that just how they interact. And you're like, oh, they got a real thing going on there. Like, that's a relationship.
And that's a problem to the rest of the locker room?
It depends on what's being leaked. Like, it depends on what's come out in the paper. If it's something that's in sports and in most, like, any kind of, I think, organization where you feel like you have that quote-unquote brotherhood or that tight-knit community, there's certain things that just aren't spoken, that just don't leave that circle. Yeah. So when you feel like that level of trust has been breached, then it's like, wait a minute.
Depends on who leaks the story, where did it come from, and you can kind of start narrowing it down to like certain groups, like what Mo's talking about. Because sometimes there's certain things that you know no one else was there. It had to be someone from the locker room. And then depending on who leaked it, who the players you see talking to certain reporters, you can kind of start getting an idea.
It's funny, like now that I'm in the, I guess we're all in the quote unquote media space, right, on that side of things, I've had players reach out to me because stories have come out and in their mind, they can't address the story, right? They can't address the story head on. Like they'll get interviewed about it and they have to just be kind of PC about it. Like, oh, like I'd rather not comment. I want to just focus on playing, blah, blah, blah.
Because you got to be careful because no one's bigger than the club, right? And if you're someone who's speaking out, how is that going to help you get other deals in the future to go to other clubs, to your point?
So they've reached out to me like, hey, look, I need this to kind of be done anonymously. Is there someone that you can put me in touch with? Is there a journalist that you trust who can get out what I want to get out there just so that my side of the story is heard?
What's your answer to that?
Why would I not? If I can help facilitate that.
Who's your journalist?
Listen, man.
Oh,
This is your messy book here. Oh, gosh, sorry.
Oh, is it there?
Yes, it's right here. If I can reach it. You just done an update to it, right? You've added.
Yes.
So you added the Miami era. You added
the World
Cup. Everybody.
Yeah.
Any versions that are thicker than that?
Dude,
is this too much?
That looks like a Game of Thrones
what?
Book. Dude, that's
an encyclopedia. I'm messy.
But you want the whole story, or you want a bit of a story?
Is there any pictures in there?
How about you?
I like stories with pictures.
Eighth grade reading and writing level. Isn't that what you said, Clint?
Writing, not reading. Okay.
You'll be able to finish that by the time you're 50.
I got my game going good.
Does that put you off when you see a book that thick?
It's intimidating.
Really? Yeah.
But
like for you. Process when you're about to write a book, you get the phone call, hey, we're gonna do this, to having it be ready, how long does it take for you?
Takes about 2 years.
2 years.
2 years and a half, something like that. But that's not that is just the first part, when you write it and you send it and you have to edit it. I hate editing. Then it has to go through lawyers.
Have you ever been sued?
So in the Messi book, I tell a story about Cristiano that I shouldn't have put in the Messi book because it was about Cristiano. And it was that when he goes into the changing room, he looks for who the enemy is in that case, and for a long time it was Messi. And he used to call Messi motherfucker.
Oh, damn.
So I put that in message book to say, look, these guys are warriors. From the moment they get into the changing room, it's like, who's the enemy, you know? And that's what Cristiano used to. But that was a period in which Cristiano and his people were trying to change his image into being like a really, really nice guy. not say that he isn't, but they make a really big effort to actually for everybody to think that way. And of course, that comes out. Now, it was going to be in Old Trafford, Argentina, Portugal, international break. No stories in the papers at that point. Nobody cares or cared so much about it. And then somebody found it in the book that I done that with the Messi book. I put that in the Messi book. Parallel to that, I had spoken, you do Messi, you have to do Cristiano. So I spoken to Chris and said, you know, I'm gonna do this book. It's not your book. And I spoke to Giorgio Mendes, his agent. Not your book, it's my book, but I want to explain via you who you are, what you've done, whatever. And Mendes, Giorgio Mendes, his agent, said to me, right, we're going to do it. You're a good guy. I've been asking around. You're a good guy, but don't fuck me around. I thought, what does that mean? I said, well, let's go for a coffee and let's discuss this thing. And I thought, once I sit down with him, he'll understand what I'm trying to do. But then somebody picked that thing from the Messi book, published it, and I was at the eye of the hurricane. It was horrendous. So every time any of you go through anything like that, I'm thinking, bloody hell. That was two of the worst days of my life, because all the news bulletins in Spain had that story. They all wanted to talk to me. I disappeared for 2 days. I did not want to be the story, but that also meant that Cristiano went onto his Facebook and says, this is a lie. I'm going to take this guy to court. Did any of you get a call from a lawyer from Cristiano Ronaldo? Because I didn't. Because I didn't publish it just freely. Obviously, double check, triple check, whatever.
Why would you ever have said to Mendes, this is not your book, this is my book? Why wouldn't you have asked him to collaborate or them to collaborate?
Because they'll have the opportunity to earn millions on doing the autobiography. That's a completely different book. And if they want me to be the ghostwriter, fine. You know, Cristiano at 8 could not sleep because he didn't smell of alcohol. He needed to bring his dad out of the bar. They all slept in the same room. And with the smell of alcohol, he will sleep better. His dad was an alcoholic.
In his book,
he will not tell that story. But that tells a lot about an absent dad, an absent mom, that because dad was an alcoholic, she had to do a lot of work for everyone. She never was home. So he has been brought up without borders, which means that he could fly. He could be whatever he wanted. He could dream of the biggest things because nobody stopped him and said, no, you have to go to school. That also has consequences. Mom has been feeling guilty all her life because she feels that she abandoned his son, who then rescued at 18 kind of thing. She went back to Lisbon to live with him because she felt, now I can look after you. And those things are fascinating because it tells a story, untold story of elite players. So that's like, let me tell that story. And Giorgio Mendes agreed, and then Cristiano put that post. And that post, that Facebook post that he sent to his 100 million followers or whatever, is the beginning of the book.
Did Messi ever reach out to you? Or did you ever have any contact with him?
Yeah, of course, yeah. From that moment, this is... Leo Messi's world is very small, very, very small. The people that work with him have worked with him for a long time. He's got Pepe Costa, who's next to him constantly as a personal assistant. Anyway, I could name the 4 or 5 people that are always with him. And at that point, having done the book, they started calling me to do commercial events with him. So we sold shaving things, and we sold phones, and we sold all kinds of things. Not only that has helped me evaluate his progression from being somebody that at 22, 23 was like, oh my God, you know, it's like, Leo, it's okay, it's only 15 people. No, we cannot deal with this. To now, Ballon d'Or, talking hardly without any preparation and just telling the world what he feels at that moment and sharing it with the world. So that was great to see, but that meant I was part of that little small circle.
Ooh. So he speaks English, right? Because Gazan... Inter Miami go, he's trying to speak English.
So
like, where did that come from?
I remember when, must have been 6 years ago, says, Manchester City were after him. And we all knew that Pep Guardiola was going to go to Manchester City, and the relationship that broke down at some point, but had were already getting closer again, and that was a possibility. City wanted Leo in Manchester. So I said, you're going to have to start learning English. Oh, yeah, doing some lessons. The following time we'll be like, hello. He wouldn't even answer hello. So hello means hola. The lessons didn't go very far. And then when he went to Paris, I was one of the people that could interview him. And I kind of joked off camera before we started, kind of to relax him. I said, so how's your English? Oh, you know, I understand it a bit, he said. I said, you mean so you can tell referees off? Because everybody speaks, is that right? All the referees speak English, don't they?
Yeah.
From whatever part of the world. So I said, oh, yeah, yeah, so I could talk to the referees. But, you know, fluently, I don't think it'll be a language that he will speak, but certainly he has learned a little bit. But he lives in Miami. I've just been in Miami. You don't need English.
Yeah. Hey, but you can get him on Kicking It for us, right?
If you speak to him in Spanish.
We'll all learn Spanish.
Soy
bilingüe. You know what I mean?
The person you wanted to do the next one on is a player or a manager?
Still trying to figure that out.
Yeah, it's still in my head.
I prefer to tell a manager's story like I did with Pochettino.
So Jose Mourinho?
I asked Jose to do the book before Pep. He said no. And when I did Pep book, he changed his tone with me.
Yeah. Wow.
We used to, when he was in Madrid, he used to email literally from 8 to 8:15 in the morning, 20 emails. To do. It was like the early WhatsApp, I imagine. And then when I did the Pep book, our relationship became, instead of friendly, professional.
Between those two, Pep and Mourinho, like, who did you discover more about?
I followed them very, very closely, both of them. And Jose is such an intelligent man. But I will always tell him the same. You did not need to divide my country to win a game. You didn't. That's not sport. Sport should be about improving yourself, respecting the authorities, respecting the rival, respecting the referee, and try to beat the best and get that way to be the best you can be.
He created too much hatred around that Real Madrid-Barcelona game.
It was awful. It was awful. To a point that was personal in many cases, and he's like, there's no need. And I know that a little bit of the story of Pep leaving Barcelona, many from Madrid will tell you that he was just so fed up with the whole Jose Mourinho thing that he thought he had to escape. No, it wasn't that. But Jose didn't make being a manager of Barcelona at that time, being a manager of the best team we've ever seen, perhaps the best team in the world, at that point he didn't make it enjoyable. And okay, elite shouldn't be enjoyable, maybe, but it just made it really tragic and divided a country. Divided even the Santiago Bernabeu. Fans ended up being with and against. There's no need. But you need a lot of intelligence, capability of manipulating,
and
understanding humans to be able, to be able to do all that.
You mentioned World Cup. And obviously, Mo and I and Clint and I were there together. Charlie, I know obviously you were following it closely. One of the stories that just resonated so hugely and was so tragic back here in the US was the story around Grant Wall, who's a fellow journalist, a friend of yours. And I remember the night that we were doing a show and the news started to filter into the studio. Grant Wall has died. And I just remember thinking, that can't be true. Something must be wrong here. You at the time were living with him. This is something that you guys did every World Cup, every major tournament that you guys covered together. There was a group of journalists, I think you, Grant, Rafa Honigstein, maybe. And so you were staying in this home together. I think you'd gone to the game where he collapsed and later died. You'd gone there together. So left the house as a normal day, or what was that like?
So he, from day one, he was working so hard, and from day one he complained that he was tired. And there was many journalists that got a cold, and they went to hospital and were given paracetamol or whatever it was. And he had done that as well. So I'd gone back to England for a game, and then came back. And he felt he was tired, and that he had been given these tablets but weren't working. then the next day we waited for each other. So it was James Horncastle. It was Grant and I went to the stadium. And we weren't sitting too far apart. And there was, you know if you feel when something is wrong, things are happening, there's noises, there's movement that is
the
not
energy,
usual.
The energy, you change it.
Yeah, I got a call from James Horncastle and says, Grant has collapsed. So what do you mean? It's like, this is in the middle of the game, Argentina-Holland, wasn't it? And yeah, when obviously head was gone and started run to where he was, they're trying to resuscitate him. And eventually, a long time after that, they took him away. James and I left the stadium, went to the hospital and waited for, I don't know how long it was, half an hour, 40 minutes. And we got in touch with his wife, and I was like, he's gone. It's like, how do you mean? It's like, gone.
Did you have the conversation with her?
Yes. Well, no, James rang, and then I spoke to her as well. Infantino, the president of FIFA, came over as well, just to present his respects and to see he heard something had happened.
Was he ever revived at the stadium, or had he died on site?
No, he just a vein burst. Something that he had in him, and at some point was going to happen, and could not be identified. And I think James wanted to go after that, so he left very soon after that.
Left
Qatar altogether. We weren't there. I wasn't there. But Messi was doing his thing, and I felt I needed to be there. We needed to tell who Grant was. Because his influence is still there. So much so that to hear him in the CBS documentary would be absolutely wonderful. He was very, very proud of it, showed me bits of it. And he was he's referenced already. I think he was off camera. Clint, you mentioned him. So, because he was the big reference of sports journalism and writing. I knew who he was and what he did and how he did it. But we always make sure that there is a swimming pool wherever we stay in World Cups, European Championships, and there was a pool in the place. For me, the pool is the place to actually disappear, you know, go into the pool and relax and whatever. And I thought for him it was the same. So we went the first day to the pool together. And there were some people hanging around. It's like pool, people, and I go pool. He goes, people. And starts talking to the people, and he gets an amazing story that then he tells us. Somebody, well, it's a long story, but anyway. So I thought, that's your magic. And that's what, you know, if I think at times where you want pull and you have to go people, it's like, Grant would have gone there, so let's go people.
When we were there for that and Grant's passing, I remember, like, having feelings of, like, similarly questioning myself, like, do I really need to still be here? I'm just curious, like, as you had conversations with those who were even closer to him, like obviously yourself, but those in the journalist space, what kind of impact and how did they all handle that moment as well?
You wonder what we're doing here. What is it for? What where do we go next? Or what, you know, have you got the balance right? And I've personally done a big effort to balance things out. I have. So that's tribute to Grant as well.
The lasting impact.
That he made us think, yeah, definitely, definitely.
I didn't know that you wondered, man, do I really need to be here?
It was just a weird feeling because, like, I was like, I'm here to talk about people kicking a ball, and he came here for that same purpose, and he's not returning home. I just kept thinking about everything, like the different layers to it, the phone call his wife's receiving, the phone call that she's receiving, you have to come over here and identify his body. Like, all that was just like, it hit me hard. Just, I don't know if it's because I have younger kids, but I just started thinking in my head the idea of, like, Michelle receiving that call, trying to convey that message to my kids. Like, I was like, bro, I need to, for a moment there, I just was second guessing me being there.
It's logical. I remember looking around, and there was extra time, and I know everything else that was going in that game, and it was like, I don't know how to describe it, but it was like, it was surreal. Why haven't they not stopped? Why is the world still going on? Why is it still spinning?
I'm curious, like, the evolution of the game, right? There's been so many changes from the introduction of VAR to expanding the World Cup, and you've covered this game, this sport, for too much time, right? And so I'm just curious your perspective on how the game has evolved and changed. Do you think some of the changes have been good and impactful? Are you optimistic? Are you bullish about the direction the game is heading, or do you miss some of the old days?
The technology, it's here to stay. I understand that, and it's useful for some stuff. VAR just multiplies the controversy, because at the end it's people using it. So
that's that. I agree with that for sure.
That's in terms of the technology. But if you talk about evolution, for me, one of the most fascinating stories and being able to write about him and follow it closely and seeing it, it's what Pep has done, Pep Guardiola has done with football. That is just, we've seen a genius at play. He's taking football to another place. And the amazing thing was that he has been able to explain what this evolution is. And we've studied it, and through it, we understood football better. I got my coaching badges because I wanted to know even more. And he's taking football to another level. Not everyone understands it. He's still doing that in front of our eyes and in the most difficult of leagues. That is amazing. And the also amazing thing is that who's going to follow that up? Because he's got two more years left at club football.
Shall
and after that, that's it. So he's going to have
you
this
say
year.
That with confidence?
I'm convinced. 2 years,
you're
end of his contract.
You're convinced because he told you?
It's
I love asking Guillaume these questions.
Do you see him going into international?
Coaching the U.S.
Definitely.
Team?
U.S.
Oh, wait, I wasn't finished with the question.
Oh. Let's move on quickly. I think in his mind he's had this idea that at some point, you know, his back is killing him. He had an operation. He's better now. But if he cannot physically give absolutely everything, then maybe the time is to actually slow down and do something else.
And meaning he always, national team?
Yeah, he always had the idea of a break and then national team. And national team, he can choose. England, Italy, Holland, Argentina, not sure Brazil.
England, please.
Would he consider US, do you think?
I think if he, you have to give him the, because people use so many sticks against him, but one of them is, yeah, but he has really good players to win. And it's like, well, if you're a NASA astronaut, you're not going to give him a Vespa to go to the moon, are you? I mean, you've got this guy that is a genius. Give him everything to see how far he can take the game, which he's doing, taking it further than anybody else we know. So give him the opportunity to win, and then maybe. So I think England.
Wow.
He would love that.
Because he's been there so long?
And he's dealt with the players. He's improved the players.
How often would you say you speak to Pep? Pretty often.
When is necessary, let's put it that way.
What is he doing in the off season? Where does he spend his time?
He used to be learning and mixing with people and whatever. Now it's golf and resting.
We're trying to dig into this England topic here, Mo. What are you doing?
Well, hold on, does he ever spend time in, I don't know, New York City?
I'm not sure if he's come back. I don't know. Obviously, he stayed here in his sabbatical, and it's one of his favorite cities.
I think you brought up a good point. Who's next? And I feel
I've got
that
it. I've got the answer to that.
Xabi Alonso is the next manager, right? He's played under Pep. He's played under Ancelotti. He's played under Jose Mourinho, Rafa Benitez, and what he's been able to do with this Leverkusen side.
Did he say before that he said Busquets would be a good coach, didn't he?
I tell you what I think. Xabi Alonso, so he goes to Bayer Leverkusen and thinks, if it doesn't work well, I go to Real Sociedad and start over. If it goes well, Real Madrid or Liverpool. So he's going to have and it's going so well, that next, whenever that is, it'll be Liverpool or Real Madrid. That's the plan, the master plan. He's not doing anything that is like absolutely new, but he's doing a mixture of things that allow the team to win. But just very briefly, Pep Guardiola taught us a new way of building from the back, of getting the ball through the middle, of actually preparing for the last pass. He's done all that and he's new. He's got 2 years left. The next step will be to organize attacks. So attack where, forget your instinct, you're going to have to do what has been trained. it goes against Urane's thing. You don't want to do it. Players don't want to do it. He will need another 10 years to get there. And he will know how to, and he would. But he's got 2 years. So now he got a guy that scores the goals and four centre-backs playing. So the areas are, the boxes are sorted. Let somebody else get with the evolution of football. And there's only one manager that has understood that and has put in practice the next phase, the organise of the attack.
Dun, dun, dun. Who is it?
Drum roll.
And it's Roberto De Zerbi.
Oh. Wow.
Roberto De Zerbi. They speak for hours. They speak in the language that only them two understand. When they're talking, everybody leaves the room after half an hour because they don't understand what they're talking about. And Pep has taken things from Brighton, and Roberto De Zerbi is Brighton. Obviously the other way around as well. Because they, Pep, I think, understands that's the guy. So I think he could end up being his replacement at City and take football to another level.
If he had the choice between the US men's national team, who'd be going into a pivotal World Cup 2026, right? And the English national team, stacked with talented players. Who do you think he would choose?
U.S.
As somebody who speaks 100%. To him.
To do well with U.S., the golden generation.
For 2026, you said?
To be able to make these guys take it to the next level, everybody would be like even more of a genius.
Do any of you speak to Pep?
It just wouldn't be as impressive. Wouldn't you want to do the most impressive thing?
But he doesn't really have time to work with them as a national coach. He doesn't.
If you're an F1 driver, do you want to drive a Ferrari or a Fiat?
Well, hold on, we have Fiat. Don't hate on Fiat. Bro,
you see that Fiat in the World Cup?
I could put some different engine in that thing, get some nitros. You don't even know what I'll be doing in that thing.
But I think this is also important context. With the national team, you're taking the best players. So it's not that you need to re-educate them.
Unless you have educated them already.
Which would be the case.
Well, there's not.
With an English national
team. Coach, yeah, but who? Jude Bellingham.
That's Guillaume's answer,
everybody.
I'm not feeling it. Saka or Jude Bellingham?
No, but Saka, who's managing Saka?
Mikel.
Who is?
A disciple.
Who was managing Jude Bellingham? Say, at Borussia Dortmund, they followed his teaching very closely.
Hey, Gio with that Dortmund?
Yeah, Gio.
So it was Christian.
I should just have terms of Klopp. I just think that is but we're talking what, 2026? So Gareth Southgate, what do we do with him?
Listen, if Pep's on the market.
Oh, so you're saying bin him now.
Even if he were to win the Euros, you would bin him.
For Pep?
You'd bin him.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wow. Messed up.
Look at you. Look at you.
Some people just say loyal you. These days.
Loyalty. The way Gareth is.
He'd step aside.
I think he would.
You can have
this Pep. This is crazy. It may not ever happen. But I think it'll go like, Pep, are you ready? You know, he's had a long time with the national side. And
I think if Pep watched the game against the U.S. versus England in the last World Cup,
yep.
He's saying, yeah, there's something with
that. I did
US
that mistake
team.
Once. I was a Barcelona fan as a kid, and Espanyol beat Barcelona at 7-2, and I thought Espanyol is better.
And I'll do that.
Look, see, you've come here with the print, the flowers, the all of it, and then you look at these three variations of brown.
Yeah, but it's cool. They're cool, yeah.
It could be. This is me dressing up.
I know.
I knew that Mr. G was going to be here, you know.
That's why
I
went to
I'm not wearing my Crocs, you know. I was trying to.
Yeah, it could be cooler, couldn't it?
I don't know. They're just sometimes it's how you walk and how you talk that makes you cool, not what you wear. Right. I've got the look, but, you know, need to improve on the other bits.
You're sponsored by a company, though, is that right? You get your shirts for free?
Yeah, I went to a shop, and I was like, oof, I wanted this, and the 8 shirts I got, they were all Guy London. And I thought, I talked to my agent, I said, would you just give them a call?
I
and
guess
say
I like
that,
them.
Yeah, I want to wear them, and every 3 months I get this massive box with
full
awesome.
Of stuff.
Well, here
it's you go, Christmas send some the boys' way. You want to send some the boys' way?
We love free.
I love
free. $3.99 is the best price
ever. We love free. I'm not going to deny that.
Do you have any spares?
I've got a couple of shirts that I brought, actually. I wonder what you will feel by wearing them. Who wants to be the volunteers?
Here we go. Lucas got them.
I rock everything.
Now, I'm... Yeah, see, I...
Ooh, I'll take the dark one.
Is that octopus? Elephants.
That logo of my shoes.
I'm a big elephant guy, but I can rock this too.
You're okay. A big elephant
Clint,
guy?
You're left out. You didn't have anything for Clint?
Sorry.
Let you me see this.
Balling on a budget.
What, over the turtleneck?
Mo, you grabbed that really quick.
It goes well with my
outfit
already.
It goes.
All right, come on, change.
Come on, let's see, Charlie. Let's see it.
You can't just get it. You have to put it on.
You want me to go change and do all that?
You can't put it on over your turtleneck?
Turtleneck? Damn, relax.
GM, yeah. It has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been awful.
Long time friend, long time colleague.
Definitely.
Long may it stay so. I appreciate you. Thank you for coming.
Yeah,
thank you.
Always good to see you. Now, you heard what he said. It's not about, you know, the shirt. It's about the way you walk, the way you wear it, the swagger.
You know I got the walk.
Let's see this walk.
Appreciate you, my man.
Okay,
yeah.
Mo.
Yeah.
Okay, Mo.
Yeah. Oh, this whole thing?
Oh, come on, man.